We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Tenor sax of jazz musician John Ellis to our guest today. Rafe Belhado is the new director of the Hillel Foundation, at least for this year, interim director. Welcome, Rafe.
Thank you.
And your spouse, Jessica Cavanaugh, is the program director. How did you arrange it so that you both got jobs here at the same time?
Well, we didn't really. that was sort of part of our agreement. When we were contacted about these positions, it was sort of a little bit of a last-minute kind of thing. And we they offered the job to Rafe and to me at the same time, basically. It was sort of part of the condition of us being employed.
And you were off ready to do something else, Rafe. What you'd been accepted in rabbinic school.
Yeah, that's right. I was accepted to rabbinic school at Yeshivat Chovavei Torah Rabbinical School, and we were actually in a hotel on 103rd and Broadway in New York City when we got the call from the guy who is now my boss, saying that my predecessor had left and would we possibly be interested in doing a deferral to take this on for a year because he needed somebody in a hurry.
So you two and Jessica, you'd been accepted in a graduate program in New York as well.
Yes.
And did you even own a car? You were going to be in New York City.
We still hadn't moved yet. We were looking for apartments. We were in New York looking for apartments. I mean, had he called maybe 24 hours later, we probably would have had an apartment already. And so, you know, it was this very close timing. But we still had an apartment in Chicago, and we still had all of our things in Chicago at that point.
So do Jews have a doctrine of providence, of predestination? Was this bound to happen?
There's a phrase, etzba Elohim hi, it is the finger of God. I don't know if I want to say that for sure God arranged this, but it sure seems like a lot of little pieces lined up in a row to make this happen.
I suppose after a year, both you and the students and others involved at Hillel will be able to know.
Well, there's another phrase, man plans and God laughs, which I think also was part of how we were feeling. So we had made all these plans, and suddenly, in sort of almost the last minute, everything changed.
Now, you two come from different branches of Judaism in terms of how you were raised. Jessica, your family was Reformed. Is that right? You were raised in at least partly in Decatur, Illinois, I remember reading.
Yes, yes. My parents actually still belong to the Reformed Synagogue in Decatur. And that's where I was bat mitzvahed and confirmed and spent my high school years as a young Jewish person.
And where were you born?
I was born in Durban, South Africa.
How did that happen?
Well, as I say, my parents were there.
Makes it convenient.
Yeah. My dad's family had been there for quite a while by that point. They came down in the early 20th century, and my mother's family had come down after the Second World War. It was one of the sort of safe places for those who were leaving, which for them was Poland and Russia. So it was one of the places that Jews went after the Holocaust.
And what brought them to the United States?
A number of things. I think a lot of it had to do with the sort of dangerous situation. This was the early to mid 90s. It was pretty dangerous. They hadn't had the elections yet in South Africa. The economic situation continues to not be great, and at that point was not great. And they were looking at a lot my future what would my prospects be? Because you can still get a great education there. It's just a matter of what do you do after that?
Sure. Did you have brothers and sisters?
No, it's just me.
Only child.
Yeah.
So you were raised Reformed Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Rafe, you were raised Orthodox. Is that correct?
Sort of.
Okay. Explain that.
Well, the family went through a long period of evolution in our Jewish practice that ended up in different members of the family identifying with different streams.
Okay.
We had gotten interested in being more observantly Jewish after my father went on sabbatical in Sweden in 1986, and I was at that time 4 years old.
And Sweden is known as a hotbed of...
Oh, there's a lot of Jews in Stockholm, actually, I mean, relatively speaking. My brother and I and my mother went over and joined him there for 10 weeks in the summer of 86.
But are there many Orthodox Jews in Stockholm?
Yes, there are. Okay. I mean, yeah, I don't know about... I believe Stockholm has about 20,000 Jews,
okay,
of whom some proportion is Orthodox. So there's probably a few thousand there, but for Sweden, that's a lot of Jews.
Sure.
But at any rate, when we got back, my parents noticed that my brother and I had begun to pick up some Swedish and some Icelandic, and they realized that, we've spent a lot of effort teaching the kids how to be Swedish. What have we done to teach them how to be Jewish? And they made a decision that they should try to invest more in becoming more religiously observant, I guess. So we started going to Sinai Temple, which is a Reform temple, and it has at it what's called a traditional service, and that's capital T, traditional, and that's similar to conservative Judaism, but I don't think that they officially affiliate with the conservative movement.
Uh-huh.
And they met about once a month, and so the other 3 weeks of the month, we prayed at the Orthodox service at Hillel. And I think as the years went by and we became more and more interested in being religiously observant, I believe my mother identifies as a conservative Jew, my father and I identify as Orthodox Jews, and my brother is not practicing.
Okay. So you have, in Christian circles it would be called ecumenism within the family. What do you call it in Judaism?
Normal.
Normal.
Jewish folks are known for their sense of humor, and you've already demonstrated that. Why do you think that is?
You'd rather laugh than cry. I think there's always this sort of, you know, humor born of tragedy. But also, I think it's a way of thinking about the world.
But doesn't it also express hope?
Yeah, I think that's also a good part of it. You know, you laugh because you want to keep going. You know, it's if you cry, you stop. But if you laugh, well, you can maybe keep going, move forward, you know, move on with things.
Uh-huh.
You know, take that break and just keep going.
We're talking with Jessica Cavanaugh, the new program director at Hillel for at least a year, and Rafe Melhado, who's the new executive director of Hillel. We're talking about them growing up in Decatur and Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and coming to this brand new position just this, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks?
No, about 2 months ago.
About eight weeks ago now.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was a very good article about them with a nice photograph in the Friday News Gazette for those of you in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. But, of course, we have people all over the state of Illinois and Indiana as well, and people on the Internet, literally around the world, who can't see how young you are. Now, can we talk about that?
Sure.
How old are you?
I'm 25.
And I'm 28.
So this is a pretty responsible position to be head of Hillel, admittedly in an interim role, but for a year, this particular Hillel was the very first Hillel in the world, right?
Yeah.
It's quite noted, exceptionally busy place, brand new building. Why did they pick you?
That's hard to say. I think I had been working at the University of Chicago Hillel for the last 3 years, and we have a pretty unique situation up there because the director there, his name is Daniel Liebenson, he's really interested in trying to get a think tank paired with that particular Hillel. And the think tank would be analyzing issues of emerging adulthood with a focus on the Jewish college campus scene, in which they would be trying out new techniques, at least in thought, for how to engage Jewish students with their Jewish identity and growing as young Jews into adulthood, and that they would then use the ideas that would be produced in that think tank to try them out in the Hillel, and that functionally the Hillel would be a tool of the think tank instead of vice versa. So what that meant is in order for him to raise funds and raise personal and political capital to get that off the ground, he had to transfer into my work profile a lot of things that typically executive directors tend to keep for themselves. And what that meant is that because we're under the same system, all the Hillels in the state of Illinois are owned by the Jewish Federation in Chicago. And so we have a lot of the same administrative structures. And it happened that I had a lot of on-the-job experience, not to say that I was the director in any way. I have to say that I was profoundly the director of operations and not the director of the entire Hillel. But that being said, I think when my predecessor left, they knew that I was from the area and that unlike a lot of people, I would not be turned off by the location. And in fact, it would be good to be near the folks. That I also had the 3 years of experience at University of Chicago Hillel.
Where were you an undergraduate?
I was an undergraduate right here at University of Illinois, and that's actually it was at Hillel that Jessica and I met and fell in love.
So that history may not have hurt either, that you had experience at this Hillel. You were active as students yourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Jessica, I mean, her area of interest is in nonprofit management, particularly with the focus on the Jewish community. And when she was a student here, she was on the student leadership board. And as program director, it is her job now to be the primary liaison to the student leadership board from the staff. And so I think she had a lot of particular skill in that area and in this particular Hillel.
You sound very proud of your wife. How long have you been married?
3 years. Yeah, just this past September, actually. September 2nd was our anniversary.
So you met at the University of Illinois. How long had you known each other by the time you decided to get married?
Oh, boy. We had been, by the time we got engaged, we'd been dating for 15 months. And we'd met my freshman year. So, I mean, probably close on 4 years by the time we decided to actually get married. I mean, we'd only been dating for the 15 months, but we'd seen each other around, we'd been friends, sure. You know, and sort of the beauty of Hillel is you sort of hang around with lots of different kinds of people, yeah. You know, in the same building and get to know a lot of people.
There was a long period of time where I was interested in her and she had no idea, so it took a little while to get off the ground.
Marriage outside of the Jewish faith is a big issue with Jews around the world. Were your parents delighted that you happened to fall in love and chose to marry someone else who was Jewish?
Yes. I mean, I think there's always that sort of worry of, like, you know, what's going to happen to, you know, to your kids when you go, you know, when they go away to college. I think people are aware that you know, in Hillel, yes, you have a lot of Jews who get together and mix, and we know a lot of couples actually who have met at Hillel.
Sure.
But, you know, there's also the greater university community. There's a lot of people here and anywhere. And I think there's definitely that worry. I think for our families, maybe, you know, both my father and Rafe's mother converted. And so that was sort of, so there was, you know.
They knew that could happen.
They knew it could happen.
Sure.
And they were, you know, I mean, I think everybody's aware of what's happening.
Now, I don't mean to bring up something that might be unpleasant, but did either of you date non-Jews when you were younger?
Yeah, I certainly did. I mean, I don't think it was unpleasant. I had a great time, honestly, with my non-Jewish girlfriend. We dated for probably 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my parents definitely took the attitude that, I mean, my father was a Jew dating a non-Jew, meaning my mother, when they began dating. And so what could they say? You know,
sure.
There's a point at which they can't shake their fists and tell me not to date a non-Jew because they
right.
did it themselves.
Right.
But that being said, when I broke up with my previous girlfriend, my dad did let it be known that when I was ready to begin looking again, that it might be nice if I looked for a Jew. And he said it in the most loving and understanding way. I didn't feel at all twisted.
And for listeners who might not know why that's important, tell us why that's important.
Well, particularly as a man, most streams of Judaism, I will say the major exception to that would be Reform Judaism, but most streams of Judaism look at who is a Jew from the question of either did you convert and then nobody can argue because you have papers, or the more usual process is that you're born of a Jewish woman. And so as a man looking for a spouse, you should be looking, if you want to have Jewish kids, then you should be looking for a Jewish wife. In the case of women, that's not a problem, obviously, because even if you intermarry, then your children are still Jewish. But there are a lot of rabbis who will not perform a wedding ceremony of a Jew and a non-Jew. And so there's a certain extent to which the community would not recognize and approve of your marriage. I think all streams of Judaism are having to address and struggle with intermarriage because it's becoming normative. But if you're asking what are the challenges, those are the challenges.
And let me push it just one step further, because some listeners may want to know, why does it matter whether you have Jewish children or not?
I mean, I think there's a number of, you know, I mean,
this is a pluralistic society. I mean, we should be open to everybody, tolerant.
No, I think, I mean, there's definitely something to be said for being tolerant and being open and all of that. I think there's also something to be said for uniqueness and group identity and religion as a sort of, you know, a nice thing. I mean, it's not like it's, you know, this is the only way to have a nice life or anything like that. But I think there's something, you know, both of us have found Judaism to be very meaningful for us in our lives. I mean, it's why we're doing what we're doing. And I think, you know, to sort of feel as though that is disappearing or would, you know, be smaller or something like that would be very, unfortunate in our opinion. And I think, you know, that's where a lot of that comes from.
I mean, I would also say that as a religion that generally doesn't proselytize, if you're interested in continuity as a religion and as a society, if you're not going out and asking other people to join it, then the only way you're going to continue as a group is to make more Jews yourself.
Sure. And Jewish survival is an issue during our time. I mean, we're only 70 years from the Holocaust. There are fewer Jews still today than there were before that. So it's not a trivial issue for Jews. Is that fair?
Yeah,
I would say so.
Yeah.
Okay. We're talking again with Rafe Melhado, the new executive director of the Cohen Center for Jewish Life, the Hillel Foundation here at the University of Illinois, the very first Hillel Foundation. How many are there now around the world?
There's about 430.
430 at university campuses, working with students, Jewish students.
Yes.
Great. And also Jessica Kavanaugh, Rafe's spouse, who is the program director. They were called as interim folks here after the previous director and several staff people moved on to other positions. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, but I'm not the only one who gets to ask questions. If listeners have a comment or would like to address our guests, do give us a call. The number's 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. If it's long distance, use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. And that's true if you're listening on a computer somewhere at will.illinois.edu/AM. You may be hearing this live. And of course, this program is also archived at that same website. If you've missed part of it or won't be able to hear the end and want to catch it later, you can do that at your convenience at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith or /AM and then search for Keeping the Faith. Well, let's talk a little bit about what Hillel does. Why don't we start with you, Jessica, since the program is sort of in your pocket this year. What's happening?
Sure. We had a very nice start to the year. We did. We always do. We have a booth at Quad Day, which is a very nice way of interacting with a lot of the new students, the freshmen that are coming in.
They all circle around, seeing all the organizations all in one big day.
Absolutely, and then we do Friday night dinner, which is always a big event. We love having students come to that. The first one of the semester is always the biggest, but we have them every week during the semester.
What kind of food?
All kinds. Generally, we started the year with brisket. of course, we don't have that every week, but we do. You know, it's usually. This past week we had a really nice Chinese themed dinner, which was quite nice. And then we also have just recently finished, or are in sort of in the middle of finishing the fall holidays. So Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and this week is actually Simchat Torah, which are you sort of start with the formal being Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and by Simchat Torah it's basically. A lot of celebration of the Torah of the scriptures. So that's sort of a nice way. And now, as we're getting into October and November, you know, we're doing programming. We're working on getting freshmen involved, and also just you know, making sure that we're meeting the student needs. Rafe mentioned I work with the student leadership, and so. What I do is I help facilitate their programming. So, you know, we have meetings once a week and they talk to me about, you know, what kinds of things are they interested in doing and that sort of thing. So.
Let's talk about those holidays a little bit. What are student attitudes towards the High Holy Days, Rafe?
I think you'll find that it depends a great deal on which student you ask. I think within each denomination, there are a lot of unique needs and desires around the holidays. I think that, but if you take all the denominations together, maybe we could divide students into two basic groups, those who self-select and who for either reasons that come from themselves, like they find the holidays meaningful and they would like to go, then they show up, or those who've got the proverbial imagined parent leaning over their shoulder and telling them from afar that they should be going. And so they go not for their own reasons, but because they feel...
There'll be a phone call.
Yeah, indeed. there's one population who self-selects by coming to Hillel and by attending services on campus and finding meaning in the services. And then there's a whole group of people that is ambivalent or actually actively doesn't want to go. And we'd like to create some experiences for them on the High Holy Days that they could find enjoyable. And one of the things we always tried to make sure that we had is a staff that was on site that wasn't attending services, so that if people wanted to have introspection and talk about the meaning of the holiday without sitting through a service, if they found that didn't do it for them, that they could still come and have a meaningful experience on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur without feeling like they had to go pray, which is what the default attitude seems to be. But in terms of the holidays themselves, I think really what both of them are about is looking into yourself, analyzing the last year. What is it that you've done in the last year? Are you proud of that? Do you have something you need to change? Is there somebody you should pick up the phone and call and say, I'm sorry to? Maybe you should think about that. Maybe you should do that. Maybe you should change. Maybe you should think about what weaknesses you have that you might want to work on. And depending on how you do that and how seriously you take that, that may affect what needs that you'd have during the holidays.
I can think of two other categories of students that might show up at the Cohn Center. Perhaps someone who is raised as from a Jewish family, but who they at least were secular, and maybe their parents were, and they may be curious about what it means to be more religious. And then I can think of these days people who were raised in completely secular society, have never practiced any religion, who might just be curious. Maybe they have no Jewish connections, familially at all, who might show up and say, hey, can I get involved? Can I hang around a while? How do you react to those two folks?
Generally, we're happy that they come. I mean, frankly, I think we want everybody to have positive Jewish memories when they come through Hillel. And I think that what's really beautiful about both of the categories that you mentioned, and I'm glad that you did, is that they're very eager to ask questions. And they find that having someone give them some things to chew on and to think about is very meaningful for them, but it's also incredibly meaningful to be asking people questions and to have them say, you know, I'm somebody who's really involved in Jewish life, and I don't know the answer to your question either. And that's something that I struggle with, too. And I think just opening up the thought process for them, or saying, hey, you know, tonight we have, you know, maybe Reformed services would be your thing and you'd like to check that out. But on the other end of the spectrum, there's Conservative services, there's Orthodox services, and you can kind of shop around and see if anything is more or less appealing to you, depending on what you're looking for.
And maybe some of those people have experienced what perhaps some of our callers today will be, if they're brave enough to call in. They may experience that typical Jewish thing of where they ask a question and you respond with another question.
Yeah, I think we tend to do that. It's one of those sort of generalizations or stereotypes that I think is borne out in I think cultural experience. Uh-huh. You know, we you know, that's where we are coming from, and so it seems natural to ask questions, and that's encouraged.
Where does that stereotype come from?
I think it's borne out in almost all of the sacred texts that we have. You see in the Bible, even some of the great heroes of the Bible are asking God, you know, why are you doing this? It doesn't make sense to me. I don't like that.
And those psalms of protest.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and also, I mean, even you have like God is saying to Abraham that he's going to destroy Sodom and Amorah. And Abraham says, well, what if there's 50 righteous people? And you may understand for your own reasons, God, why you want to destroy these cities. But let me tell you how it's going to look like from people. They're going to think that you're unjust because you destroy the righteous with the wicked. And they're not going to understand it the way you understand it because you're so much smarter than them. And he starts bargaining with God about, well, what if there's 40 righteous people in the city? What if there's 30? So, I mean, I think all the way from our forefathers, we have that tradition. But I would say in general, in the scriptures of Jewish scholarship, especially legal scholarship, what's typically done is that both opinions in an argument are brought. So the way that you learn about Jewish law is not to go and read a book of Jewish law, but rather to go and read an argument about a particular issue in Jewish law and watch as it develops and reaches a terminus so that you can partake in the discussion that led to the conclusion that was drawn instead of being told without any context, such and such is the law for such and such situation. And I think that what I really like about Judaism, one of the things that's so attractive to me, is saying, I don't know, is rewarded. And asking questions and always challenging what you're told is rewarded. And I find that very fulfilling.
Of course, other religious traditions also have many different varieties and a lot of arguments within them. Islam certainly does. Christianity does, for example. And Hinduism is just full of that. But in Christianity, there's been which is what I'm most familiar with, there's been sort of a history of theology. And there's this basic doctrine that sort of everybody kind of agrees with and has been written down. And, oh, yeah, there are a lot of variations to it. But still, there's a theology. Judaism doesn't have that in the same kind of a way. Would you say something about that?
Sure. I mean, I think you're right. I think that Judaism doesn't have that kind of theology, doesn't have, you know, there's no, or there's much less of a concept of you know, dogma or anything like that. I mean, granted, there are branches of Christianity that don't have dogma either, but, you know, there
some that have way too much.
And I think, you know, that that is sort of, I mean, and it's interesting because there are lots of traditions, there's lots of customs, there's lots of things that inform the Jewish experience, but it's not written in the same, or it's not thought about in the same way as like you have to do blah to be Jewish or to be considered a Jew. I mean, you can, you know, you don't really have to do all that much to be, if you're born Jewish, to be considered,
yeah,
you know, part of the Jewish people.
Sure.
And I think that's, you know, that's part of the theology also. I mean, sort of what you could call theology is that, you know, we're part of a people, even if you're not practicing a religion. And I think there's, I had somebody ask me, you know, is it a culture? Is it a race? Is it a religion? And I'm like, these definitions don't really work or don't work the same way. You know, because if it's a race, you can't convert into a race. Or, you know, you can't get all into all this sort of like nasty connotations of race and how that's been used in the past.
Right.
It's more than a culture because it has all these, it does at least have roots. I mean, a lot of the cultural stuff has roots in religion. But if you're just looking at the religion aspect of it, you miss a lot of the, you know, you can read a book about Judaism and not understand what it means to celebrate Shabbat until you actually do it. So I think there's, you know, we're generally a religion of doing. And I think that's part of it is sort of rather than, you know, I mean, there is a lot of study, but
sure.
Yeah. One gloss that I would put on that.
Let me just say before you go on, Rafe, that Jessica was an undergraduate religion major here at the University of Illinois. And
yes.
So analyzing, comparing religions is something you've done a bit of.
Yes.
But go ahead, Rafe, you were going to expand.
Sure. I was just going to put one additional gloss on that, is that I think Jessica's answer is right on if you're looking at Judaism or Jewishness as a whole. That being said, within particular slices of Judaism, you will find that people have written voluminous works on theology, and have been, a lot of ink has been spilled, so to speak, on writing down Jewish theological beliefs in much the same way, and in fact, sometimes in direct imitation of the Christian and Muslim theologians. Within each denomination, especially after the existence of multiple denominations, there have been works of theology defending the theology of one kind of Judaism against that of another. So there has been a lot of work that's been devoted to that. But if you're looking at the ethno-religion culture that Jessica was hinting at before as a whole, then it's,
sure,
it's very hard to say Judaism says blank or the Jewish people do blah. It's harder to pin down if you're looking at the whole Jewish experience.
We're about halfway through Keeping the Faith this afternoon. We're on the air from 5 to 6 Sunday evenings here on WILL AM 580, a program of Illinois Public Media. It's also heard at 90.9 FM and HD3 in Urbana and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host. Our guests today are Jessica Cavanaugh, the new program director at the Cohen Center for Jewish Life, the Hillel Foundation at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and her spouse, Rafe Melhado, who's the executive director. Calls are encouraged, 333-9455, if you're in the 217 area code. If it's a local call, if it's long distance, use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. We're eager for people to join the conversation. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Evie and Wally Schellenberger. They are coming here for a program sponsored by the First Mennonite Church and the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, and they'll be giving a report from Iran after spending a number of years in Iran. That'll be October 3rd here on Keeping the Faith. October 10, a name that's been in the news recently, Bill Ayers, will be our guest. He's a professor of education, retired from the University of Illinois Chicago, and he'll be talking about his most recent book, To Teach, The Journey in Comics. He'll be interviewed by guest host Don Nolan. Don will be helping out for 3 weeks in a row while my wife and I are traveling. On later in In October, he'll be talking with Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago, an internationally known philosopher, about her book, Not for Profit, Why Democracies Need the Humanities. So those are some of the things coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. I might just mention that for those people who enjoy the topics on this program, I've been asked to fill in a little bit on the focus programs on Monday through Friday while David Inge is on vacation. And this coming Tuesday at 10, I'll be talking with the author of Muslims in America, a short history written by Edward Curtis, a professor in Indianapolis. It takes almost as long to say the name of his university as all my other announcements. He teaches at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. That's IUPUI. He's a native of Southern Illinois, went to Kenyon College, Wash U for graduate school, and then finally a doctorate from University of South Africa. And we'll be talking to him about his book published by Oxford University Press. That's Tuesday on Focus at 10 here at WILL AM 580. Getting back to our guests today, I see we have a caller on line 4 already from Bloomington, Illinois. Go ahead. You're talking with Rafe and Jessica.
Yeah, thank you for always good program, Steve.
You're welcome.
Let's see, I think I know how to word this. As a Protestant, I have separating myth from, you know, moral value, which is the essence of religion to me. What would I, if I would convert to Judaism, what would I, what beliefs or, you know, would I have to adopt, or am I wording that enough that you understand what I mean?
I think we understand. I'm seeing heads nodding. Let's have a response, but you might stay on the line, and we can ask a clarifying question if we don't hit it right on.
Thank you.
Well, it's a hard one to bite off. I mean, I think it really depends on what kind of Judaism that you're interested in. I mean, Jews are famously known for sometimes not even asking people to believe in God. That being said, the kind of Judaism that I am interested in, which is Orthodox Judaism, would require you to believe in God. I think the if you had to boil Judaism down to a soundbite, it would basically be that you should try to be righteous both in your own life and in your treatment of others. And there's a lot of detail that can be added to that, but that fundamentally that's what it's all about. I think if you're interested in a personal quest, I would have a different and longer conversation with you about this than I would be prepared to on the radio. But if I had to boil Judaism down to core value beliefs, it's to be righteous yourself and to be righteous to others.
I think the other thing that if you're looking at like sort of what does separate, you know, say Judaism and what you're coming from, as I understand it, is Christianity, is sort of one particular not belief, which is to not believe in Jesus as a savior. And I think that does separate pretty clearly between Judaism and Christianity. So I think that if you're talking about what would you have to believe, or I think there's also a what would you not have to believe as well.
And it's interesting, just piggybacking off of that, there is a synagogue in Charleston, South Carolina, that has translated a core belief of Judaism known as the Shema, and it's normally translated in English, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." And on the lintel of this particular synagogue in Charleston, it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is the sole divine being." And that captures a little bit what Jessica was just talking about.
Caller, do you want to ask any more?
Well, and you said as Orthodox, a person would have to believe in a God.
Yes.
What would be your definition of God?
Boy, that's a tough one. Personally, I view God as the creator of the universe, and I think that in my own humble way, I think that God is interested in what I'm doing simply because I'm a human alive on his earth. And I think that God is a very thoughtful person or being, however you want to describe him, who sees things from a totally different perspective than I ever could and is all-powerful and all-knowing. Beyond that, I find it very difficult to define God because I don't really have any proof. But if we're talking about what do I think of as a God, it's the all-powerful creator of the universe.
So that, as a Jew, you wouldn't have a specific definition. I think you mentioned, and I have heard a Jewish friend mention that maybe you wouldn't even be asked if you believe in God. Didn't you say that, or...?
If we're speaking from the perspective of Orthodoxy, you would be required to believe in God. There are other forms of Judaism that are based more. I would say what unites all forms of Judaism is that they're this worldly, meaning that the afterlife is considered to be important, and that there's an idea that what happens to you in the afterlife is directly related to your behavior in this life. But here you are right now in this life, and you're not in the afterlife, and that therefore the focus of your attentions should be on what you're doing right now. Mm-hmm. So the forms of Judaism that are less God-focused tend to focus more on doing works of social justice and improving this world, because that's the world that we inhabit now.
Yeah, that's beautiful. What would just one... Is it all right if I ask another?
Sure, go ahead.
I just, is God, and for a Jewish person, God, and I can't say that my religion believes this, but that God is not necessarily separate from us, but also part of us.
Yeah, there's a concept of Tzelem Elohim, the image of God, which is considered to be endowed in all humans. And particularly in Jewish mysticism, they talk about the divine sparks that inhabit all people. I will not purport to be a scholar of Jewish mysticism because I am profoundly not. But I do happen to know that there is an idea in Jewish mysticism of a place called Guf, which means literally the body, and it is an ethereal body containing all possible souls in the universe, and it is said to be intermingling with God and godliness, and that the divine, the messianic era effectively can only come about when all of the souls inhabiting the goof area have been doled out from God to all beings in the universe, and only when the goof is empty can the messianic era occur.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate your call. Thank you. Other callers may join the conversation, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Jessica, before we got on the air, I was asking you and Rafe a little bit about your backgrounds. You've spent time in Israel together, is that right?
Yes, yes.
How long?
Together, we were there about 10 months.
And you've each been there separately in addition?
Yeah, I was there on the Birthright Israel program, which is a program for Jews between the age of 18 and 26 who have not been to Israel before.
As an undergraduate?
Yes, I went as an undergraduate.
From here at the University of Illinois, and you have that program available today for students?
Yes, we do. We're planning on sending a group in December over winter break.
How many will go?
Right now we have about 80 students registered. I don't think all of them, unfortunately, are going to be able to go this time. But we do run programs in December and in June, so everybody will eventually get to go, but maybe not this time.
So you're running a tour for just 80 people, undergraduates. How do you do that?
The short answer is we don't. It's really through several organizations that partner with us.
Help pay for that.
The Chicago Jewish Federation, there's an actual organization called Birthright Israel. There's an organization called Shor Hashim, which is Roots, which is the group that actually leads our tour in Israel. So we partner with them. They have tour guides who are very experienced Israelis who do this with us. And I that was when I went with the Hillel group, the Hillel group meets the tour guide, and they take us around the country for the 10 days that you're there.
And the time you two were in Israel, did the Israelis react to you first as Americans or as fellow Jews?
Americans.
Yeah.
I think there was clearly, like, they understood that we were Jewish and all that, but there's always sort of the language issues and all of that kind
sure.
of stuff.
And Israel is a very interesting place, especially within Israel proper. Jews are a majority in the population, and that's unheard of almost anywhere, basically anywhere else. And it's so interesting that people presume, unless you are obviously not Jewish, of course you're a Jew. And so anything else that might be apparent about what your identity is, people are primed to see you in that light. So one of the major differences in the Jewish community is between Ashkenazi Jews, who are of European descent, and Sephardic Jews, who are of North African and Middle Eastern descent. Another big difference is in Israel, there are fewer denominational ranges. It's very polarized there. So you're either what's called dati, you're a religious person, and that generally means Orthodox. Or ultra-Orthodox, or you are chiloni, secular, and that those denominations or those differences tend to be more apparent than Jew versus non-Jew. I would also say that there are certain consonants and vowels in Hebrew that Americans find particularly difficult to pronounce, and that the minute you open your mouth, people know exactly where you're from, and that also primes them to think of you as an American.
Uh-huh. What about the politics? Did you have differences of opinion with very many people in Israel, or were you in solidarity with most Israelis, or did you differ among the two of you?
Well, I think, it's sort of hard to say, like, what does the majority of Israelis think about anything? I mean, the famous thing of, three Jews, four opinions. I think that holds true also in Israel. And we were there in a very interesting time. It was right after the war in Lebanon, and right before Hamas took power. I was sort of like the 10 months in between all of that was when we were there, and so that was a very interesting. It was a very interesting time. It was sort of like there wasn't a lot going on right then, but there were when we arrived, people were still dealing with the aftermath of Lebanon. The hotel we stayed in had a lot of refugees from the north who had come down seeking safety in Jerusalem, which is sort of an interesting twist. Most of the time, Jerusalem has not been the safest place, but at that point it was. And then, they were preparing for the elections when we left in June. And so, we didn't know what would happen, but we were sort of...
Yeah, I think a gloss I'll put on. I believe my sense of the chronology may not be that great. I believe the elections had already taken place by the time, like while we were still there, and it may have even happened before. Now it's already 4 years ago, so my memory of the chronology is funny. But I think what had happened is that Hamas had already come to power, and then what had happened is that about 3 weeks after we left, they came to control the entire Gaza Strip, which is something that they had not been able to do previously. What I would say, just in answer to your question, is that it's very hard as an American to talk to an Israeli about the politics in a challenging way, because when we're sitting here and we're 7,000 miles away, it kind of seems like an abstract concept. And often... Americans are prone to viewing Israel and the state of Israel and Zionism as these rallying concepts, and that they're parts of Jewish identity, and that the positions that you might take on Israeli politics, when you're thinking about it as a concept, are very different than the positions that you might take when the decisions that would come out of that discussion would affect you and would take place in the city in which you live, or perhaps literally in your backyard or in your neighbor's yard. And I think it's really hard for me to try to agree loudly and bellicosely with Israelis about any article of politics, because there's a sense in which I have a right to participate in the discussion as a Jew, and there's another sense in which I don't have a right to participate at that level in the discussion because I'm not Israeli.
Callers are encouraged to give us a call and talk with our guest today. Jessica Kavanaugh is the program director of the Hillel Foundation. Rafe Melhado is the new executive director, both on an interim basis. Do you know how long this interim is going to last? Have you promised to stay, what, at least a school year?
It's at least a school year, and there's sort of potential for a second. But
depending on how long the search for your permanent replacement takes?
Well, I don't think it's going to be that, meaning that, I mean, basically all we've promised is a year. I think anything beyond that would be a new discussion.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you never know how these searches go, as the people who've looking for chancellors of the university and know well. If you'd like to call, 333-9455 or long distance, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. And that includes people who are listening at will.illinois.edu/am. And I see we do have another caller on line number one. Let's go to that caller, okay? Yes, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm wondering, in a university where there are so many religious homes away from home, including some with dormitory facilities, if you'd like to immerse yourself, I'm wondering if the students who come to the Hillel program use that as a sort of safe haven from which they can venture out, and then when they need to come back and recuperate or regenerate, or some of them stay there and try not to interact with as many other forms of thinking on campus. What sort of uses have the students made of the Hillel?
Thank you for the question.
I would say that the safe haven model is something that was more profound 40 or 50 years ago, at a time where Jews were a little bit less integrated into mainstream American society. I think that Hillel can be like a hub. Maybe that's the term that I would use better, rather than a safe haven. I don't think that the campus life is threatening enough or challenging enough in quite that way for people to need to seek refuge in Hillel. That being said, Hillel is one of the only places on campus, not the only, but it's one of the only, where there's lots of Jews around all the time, and that you're more likely to see someone who's like you at Hillel, and there that can be very comforting and very meaningful for a lot of people. And so a lot of students do use Hillel as a place where they come and they'll print out a paper, and then they'll get involved with a conversation with a student who happens to be there. And before you know it, although they intended to print out their paper and then go study for an hour, it turns out that they've had a lively conversation about some issue of the day with other Jewish students. And I think that there are some people for whom Judaism is one facet of a rich identity that contains many things, and that maybe their hub is somewhere else, and that Hillel is more of a spoke. And they come in to do the Jewish spoke, and then they go on and they do other spokes based out of a different hub.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, caller, for that question. Let me follow up with one. Are current students aware of the extent to which Jews were either excluded from higher education, or there were quotas on the number of Jews that would be allowed into some very prestigious universities? So you've been both at University of Chicago and here in Illinois, and both have a bit of that history.
Mm-hmm. I think the short answer is probably not. I think the awareness is a little bit maybe lacking. But I think there is sort of a general awareness of that things were harder previously. I don't know that maybe they know the specific history of what was it like to be a Jewish student. I know, for instance, I mean, we were students here when there was the old Hillel facility, and a lot of a lot of the especially the newer students sort of like, oh, this is the new building. What was the old building like?
Sure,
And so that's, you know.
And it was built in the 1950s, as I remember. And Hillel began here in what year?
1923.
But a good decade at least after the Protestant Christian Dean of Students went around encouraging Christian congregations to start centers for students on this campus. He didn't go to the Jewish faith or even to Catholics and encourage that. They had to kind of come here on their own.
And I would say that in general, the Jews even have a term for this. It's called shichachat hadorot, the propensity of people in large groups to forget things over the generations. And that sometimes when something is getting to be several decades in the past, it tends not to be in current knowledge, and people tend not to think about that, Jews or anybody else. And sometimes things fade away that you have to spend effort to remember if you want to. And so one way to see it is that a real success of the integration of Jews into this country, how successful was it that a lot of Jews today don't even know that it was a problem a long time ago?
I think there's also there's sort of that gray area between when things become history and when things are like things that your mother, your father, your grandparents remember. They're sort of like, you know, in history class, you only get up to, you know, 1920 or 1930 unless or maybe to the World War II, and you lose some of the more recent history, because it is so recent and it's not really. People don't really know what effect did that have on today yet.
So that's recent history, but Rafe was reminding us before we went on the air in a story he was telling our technical director, Kyle Crow, something he heard, I think, was it from your grandfather?
It was my great-grandfather.
Would you repeat that story? There is another aspect to this.
Yeah, and I'll just say to my father, you'll forgive me if I've gotten the story a little wrong, but what happened is that my great-grandfather, shortly after immigrating to this country from Ukraine, he joined an Orthodox synagogue, and he had a friend who I believe was his neighbor, and the neighbor happened to notice that when he would pass by the Orthodox synagogue, he could hear the sound of worship from outside. And he happened to comment to my great-grandfather that, gee, isn't it interesting that when Jews pray, they're very loud. Can you tell me why that is? And my great-grandfather was a little surprised by the question, so he thought about it for a moment. And then he looked at his neighbor, who was Christian, and he said, well, your God, he's a young God, and his hearing's fine. But our God, he's a little bit older, and he needs some help hearing our prayers.
With that bit of humor, we will need to close. We're out of time. We've been talking with Jessica Cavanaugh, new program director, and Rafe Melhado, new executive director of the Cohen Center for Jewish Life here at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. We're happy on Keeping the Faith to have the ongoing support of University YMCA, a interfaith group on campus coming up at the Wise New University Tuesday. We'll be Robert Easter, current chancellor and provost, talking about the price tag on education. later in the week, on Friday, Jeffrey Hewings, director of Regional Economics Applications Laboratory, will be talking about reading the Illinois economy, a very important topic for these days with the state in such a state of disarray economically. Those are coming up at the University Y, the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street, on Tuesday and Friday noons. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.